Hi, everyone. I've got a bit of a cold, so apologies for any sneezing or coughing or blowing of noses. You're a very long way away, so hopefully you're not going to catch anything.
That's why everyone's
Yeah, roughly. as Sujiva said, this is the last talk in the series on the Eightfold Path, the Buddha's Eightfold Path, which is one of the fundamental teachings of Buddhism. And you could say in a way that all the Buddha's teachings are kind of are wrapped up in this Eightfold Path. We could go deeper and deeper into it. I'm not doing a summary of what was said in the first two evenings because actually I wasn't here, so I can't recap that at all. I was on I was only away for a week, but I was on three very short retreats during that week. So I'm kind of bringing a couple of themes from those retreats into my talk tonight, which, as Sujiva said, is on, it's up there, isn't it? Perfect awareness and perfect samadhi. I'll go into the definitions in a minute. So the main theme that's is part of my practice at the moment, I mean my meditation practice, but also just the way I'm approaching life, I guess, is pleasure. And I don't mean the superficial pleasure that we get from the little feel-goods that we get all day long. I mean a deeper kind of sense of pleasure and satisfaction that we can sometimes touch into even when we're with really supposedly unpleasant states of mind or unpleasant experiences. And another theme that I've been reflecting on since one of those retreats is care, in the sense of care for ourselves, care for one another, and care for the world. So this attitude of caring, it could be seen as being relevant to the whole of the Buddha's teaching. Again, that the sense of care, in every sense of the word, permeates the whole of the Buddha's teachings. But I think it's particularly important to highlight it in relation to the first kind of topic I'm talking about, which is perfect awareness or perfect mindfulness. Anyway, I'll come back to that in a minute. That's right. So now I'd like to just pass around these. Just take one and pass them on. Thanks, Sarah. And maybe you guys could take and pass on. So you don't have to do anything with them at the moment. You can just, you can make them into a pendant. You can just enjoy them. You can hang them from your ear. Yep. We'll come back to these things. So we've almost come to the end of this Eightfold Path. We had two kind of topics covered in each of the last 4 weeks. First, I'm a bit pedantic, really. I like talking about words, which I know can be annoying. But anyway, I think to start with, I think the term Eightfold Path can be deceptive, and this may have been covered in earlier talks, actually. This term path, it's not like as a Buddhist we walk along this path, you know, the first stage, the second stage, the fourth stage, third, fourth, and so on, up to eight, and then we're done. It's more like we revisit different aspects of the path, again and again and again, developing ever deeper levels of understanding as we go. And out of those deeper levels of understanding, our actions become more congruent with our higher values, and our higher values become more aligned with the Buddha's teaching. And so it goes on. So the sense of ever deepening, ever refining, if that's the right word, and becoming more aligned to the, well, the real truth of things, I suppose. So I thought about a jungle metaphor to illustrate this. We'll see how it goes. So imagine we're in a jungle. Imagine you're in a jungle. You're walking along a path in the jungle, and at the start you have a vision of your destination. So the first stage of the Eightfold Path is perfect vision. So at the start you have a vision of your destination, and then you set out and you meet or develop all the different aspects as you travel along this jungle path. So maybe you meet different animals, different trees, different plants. Maybe you swim across rivers infested with crocodiles. Maybe you encounter tigers and run away from them. Maybe you learn what plants are wholesome and which plants are poisonous. And as you go along, the vision that you had to start with is nourished, and your confidence deepens. And this path through the jungle becomes ever more fascinating and pleasurable. But you never actually reach the end of it. It's like, well, the jungle never finishes in a way. Eventually the path becomes more like a playground, say, than a journey. And you realize eventually that the crocodiles and the tigers and whatever else you encounter are just fabrications of your own mind. And in the same way, that you could say that your mind is just a fabrication of the jungle, which is getting pretty esoteric now. This realization doesn't come all at once. There are moments of relaxing into the jungle, really enjoying the jungle, and moments of striving and struggling and running away from those same old tigers or whatever. But it deepens over time, and you could say that this last aspect of the Eightfold Path that I'm going to come to, perfect samadhi, is the full maturity of this deepening and aligning with the jungle. So bring yourself out of the jungle, I'll talk a little bit to start with about awareness. It's up there as awareness, isn't it? Perfect awareness, yeah. So it's sometimes also translated as perfect mindfulness. And then the last one is samadhi. So along with perfect effort, which Sarah talked about last week, so these are the last three aspects, say, of the path. They make up the stage of the path which is concerned with mental training. So the effort that Sarah talked about last week could be seen as a support for awareness and samadhi, these last two. For example, those of you who are here will remember Sarah talked about the four right exertions or four right efforts that are ways in which we cultivate a skillful mind and skillful activity. And in a way, we need mindfulness or awareness in order to know what's going on in our mind, in order to practice with the four right efforts and so on. So these last three stages, all three aspects, all feed into each other. So mindfulness or awareness, the seventh aspect or limb or stage of the path. It seems to me the way, the word mindfulness is used a lot these days. It's used in all sorts of settings. And I think there's a danger if we take that common everyday usage of the word mindfulness as a given, that it feels kind of somewhat disinterested, unemotional, a kind of almost surgical attitude to life. Like one of the places where I work, people often say to each other, be mindful of such and such, as in just pay attention to, really. There's not much heart in that kind of usage of the word. The word that mindfulness is a translation of is the word sati in Pali, the ancient Indian language. So sati has very rich connotations. It's related to the words remember and recollect. So in that sense, it suggests both awareness of the this moment, the present moment, and a a recollection or memory of the past. And in that way, it also suggests a continuity of purpose between past and present, an awareness of what's truly important based on our actions and learnings in the past and the way we want our lives to develop. So I think this is a really important point. Mindfulness suggests a breadth of mind more than a narrow focus, which I think is how it's sometimes used these days. So I came across a simile which illustrates this, which I hope I can communicate. So imagine in ancient India there's a cow herd in the fields watching the cows, as cow herds do. And there's places the cows can roam, but where the crops are, maybe rice or wheat or whatever, the cows can't go there, but there's no fences. So the cow herd has to be really on the ball, watching the cows and, you know, chasing the cows away from the rice and the wheat and whatever, and just making sure they only graze where they won't damage the crops. And then after the crops are harvested, the cow herd can sit back under a tree, I'm imagining the cow herd sitting under a tree and watching the cows graze wherever they like, really, in a very relaxed, still attentive, but a very relaxed way. And this latter posture or attitude is what I think sati or mindfulness is getting at. Not sleepy, not drowsy, not dozing off in the shade, but relaxed, attentive without being without straining. So that's what we're talking about when we talk about mindfulness or sati. So as I hope you can see, sati or mindfulness is about having a clear overview rather than an intense focus. And some modern scholars say it's the importance of sati or mindfulness is it makes things conscious rather than eliminating them. So it's concerned with that breadth of awareness that enables things to come into consciousness, and you use other qualities to eliminate things, if that's the right use of the word. It's more about, you know, watching things arise, just like the cow herd watches the cows graze. It's also related to what's called in Buddhism bare attention. So bare attention is like just noticing what's arising, just noticing the cows grazing, say, without proliferating, amplifying, exaggerating, going into thoughts or plans or memories or fantasies or you know, all the things we do with the information we receive through our senses. So the founder of our movement, whose name is Sangharakshita, he came up with an aphorism that's really widely used in Triratna, in our tradition. And he said, awareness is revolutionary. So awareness, the sense of sati, is revolutionary. So when I was thinking about giving this talk, I was asking myself, well, so what's so revolutionary about sati? What's so revolutionary about mindfulness? So, of course, I turned to Google. And the word revolutionary comes from the Latin word, I don't really know how to say it, but it's something like revolutio, which means to turn around. And, of course, the word revolution also has radical associations. It's about a deep and fundamental change with connotations of personal power and freedom. And also, I think, of collective effort. If you think of revolutions, they involve collective effort, a coming together. So what this aphorism, awareness is revolutionary, suggests, I think, is that awareness or sati can harness and unify our energies, collect them together, and bring about a deep change that leads to freedom and power. Another teacher, whose name is Reggie Ray, has said that the Dharma, that's the Buddha's teaching, results in a reversal of the normal logic of the ego. So it's a reversal of the normal logic of the ego, which I find a really lovely and challenging expression. A reversal is like, I'm quoting that little phrase because reversal to me is a bit like revolution, turning about. So he's saying that the Dharma will not only change things, change how we see things, or change how we behave, it will completely change how we approach the world, completely reverse how we approach the world, turn it around. I was thinking the normal logic of the ego is pretty basic if you think about it, really. Our unmediated, uncensored tendency is to push away or try and kill or destroy what we don't like, and to grasp or consume what we do like. I mean, you could argue over the details, of course, but you could say that's kind of the ego in action. Pushing away things, ideas, or people that we make us feel bad, or that we feel bad around, and pulling towards ourselves things, ideas, or people who make us feel good. And this has been referred to as doggy consciousness. So as soon as I hear doggy consciousness, I think of a Labrador. You know how if they like things like food, they go, yum, yum, I'll eat that. Walk, yes, yes, I'll go. Jingle of keys, wonderful, walk. Oh, no, you're leaving, sulk. So it's just that moving towards or moving away endlessly. That's like a doggy consciousness. And that's very bluntly speaking, that's how we lead our lives a lot of the time. So the Dharma, the Buddha's teaching as a whole, and particularly sati or awareness, as we develop it, as we practice, helps us learn that this doggy consciousness, even though it's easy and quick, it doesn't actually bring about long-term happiness. It really only gives us brief moments of feeling good. Like a dog. Yum, yum, I'll eat that. Yum, that was great. What next, what next, what next, you know? Always something more. And the Dharma also helps us see, or awareness, or sati also helps us see that our experience is rich and interesting, that other people, other beings are rich and interesting, and that actually we don't need to do pulling away or pulling towards things or people to have deeply rich and interesting and satisfying experiences. The Buddha's teaching enables us to engage much more fully with our experience, to be more sensitive to it, and to respond in ways that create happiness for ourselves and others, rather than suffering. So sati, this kind of leads me on the sense of sati as being attending to or being with, rather than pushing away or pulling towards. It evokes in me a kind of a sense of a really very intimate, involved, sensitive response to the world. And I want to quote from an article a psychotherapist friend of mine wrote. So he's writing about empathy, and his main thing is about our developing care for the world around us. He's particularly concerned with our often destructive and uncaring attitude towards the natural world. So he says, this is a psychotherapist writing, "It seems we must learn over and over again the lesson that we cannot truly understand anything until we can also learn to love and care for it. Empathy is the dawn of understanding. Antipathy, by contrast, forecloses understanding, as it reductively misrepresents everything we objectify and exploit, leaving in its wake a mere semblance or shadow of true being." So that last sentence is quite dense. I'll just unpack the whole paragraph a bit. So he's saying that empathy allows us to truly love, understand, and care for the world around us. I mean, it's simple, eh? We know that. And he's saying it's opposite, antipathy. It inhibits or limits our understanding, and it results us in us objectifying and exploiting the world rather than engaging with it in a heartfelt way. And the suggestion I'm making in this talk is that the sort of empathy he's describing can only come out of sati or awareness. Yeah? The seventh part of the Eightfold Path. And a Buddhist teacher who visited us last year, who many of you met, Visantra, he made a similar point, but he came from the more radical or revolutionary perspective of the Dharma, of the Buddhist teaching. And he reminded us that we naturally, this was on a retreat that I was on that some of you weren't on, but you might have, he might have said similar things wherever you met him. He reminded us that, we naturally identify with some bits of our experience and not with others. So for example, we call our physical experience, you know, what we feel inside of us, we call that me, while most of the visual sensations we receive, we call other, right? You all out there, I see through my eyes, your other stuff I'm feeling in here, I call me. And he suggests that we need to care for ourselves, for others, for the world with equal attention. He said, all you need to do is open to experience and care for it, whether the experience is experience that you label me, or the experience is experience that you label other. And he, I mean, this is not that relevant to this talk, but anyway, it was a great point anyway. He was talking about awareness or sati. He said a few years ago he gave a Dharma talk and at a Buddhist center like this, and the center is quite a well-known figure in our movement. He gave a Dharma talk and at the end of it, somebody said to him, oh, that was a terrible talk. And he said, That phrase, that was a terrible Dharma talk, that only lasted 1.5 seconds, and he, you know, timed it to find that out. But its reverberations could stay with him for hours, for days, for weeks, for months, for years, right? It could even change his entire life if he spent enough time thinking about what this person said to him about his talk. And he suggested that with sati, we can stop that mental proliferation, that all that self-talk that we do that turns 1.5 seconds of sound into this huge experience that might, you know, have a huge and perhaps not very helpful impact on our lives. So you can just keep reminding yourself it is only 1.5 seconds of sound. So, mindfulness. I'm just coming back to it because I think how it's taught these days is a wee bit limited. And I mean, I say that as someone who teaches mindfulness in one of my jobs. I teach mindfulness to people in recovery from addictions. So I know that the way mindfulness is taught these days is very, very helpful and does, is very helpful to alleviate suffering. But I think the way the Dharma approaches mindfulness, or doesn't approach it, the way it is mindfulness really, the way it teaches it or conveys it, offers the possibility of much more profound happiness and freedom than what secular mindfulness can do. I think equating the mindfulness that you might learn on what I'm, you know, on the kind of thing that I'm teaching elsewhere, or maybe the kind of thing that Kusalamani is teaching elsewhere, might be a bit like equating a tree in the jungle that we've been walking through with the whole of the jungle, right? It's lovely. It's a lovely tree. It's got fruit on it. It's gorgeous. But it's not the whole of the Buddha's teaching. The whole of the Buddha's teaching is so much more rich. So I want to, I don't know how this is going to work, but anyway, some of you might have heard of the raisin exercise, which we do on mindfulness courses, and basically everyone gets a raisin, everyone in the group gets a raisin, and they lead through a mindfulness exercise where they feel the raisin, they look at the raisin, they really get to know the raisin, taste it, or smell it, taste it, texture in the mouth, swallow it, feel it as it's going down. So they really spend time. How long, Chris Lamani? 5 minutes? 5 minutes with this one raisin. And it's mind-blowing, eh? Very transformative. So that's a really very useful exercise for people who are learning about mindfulness. They really get to see how much of their experience they just don't take in. But the Dharma, the Buddha's teaching, takes that even further. So I'm going to see how this goes. So what have you got in your hand? Or in your hand or beside you? What is it?
Leaf.
It's called a leaf. That's the label, is it, for it? Now look at it. Well, I just want you all to help me. Help each other. What do you see?
Colour.
What colour?
Orange.
green, yellow, black, red, grey.
Okay, stop, Sarah. Any other colours?
more.
There's got to be more.
White.
It's
an autumn leaf.
Autumn leaf. Right, great. Another label, autumn leaf. Yeah? Are any ones here that aren't autumn leaves? No.
I see the...
Ah, what colour's your one?
Mine's green with a slight tinge of brown along the sides, on the edges.
Right. What else can we find out about this leaf? What is it? What does it feel like? Soft?
Mine's soft. Not soft, it's crinkly and wrinkled.
Crinkly and wrinkled.
Textures.
Velvety. Velvety, nice. What else is there?
Fragile.
Fragile.
Got a shape like a turret. I think it looks like a heart.
We're on to touch now. Touch. Wrinkled, velvety, fragile.
Oh, sorry.
Ridged.
You can feel the texture of the ridges, yeah. Has it got a smell?
No. Well, yes.
Yes? What is it?
Fruity.
Fruity?
Yeah. Sort of grassy.
Grassy?
Musty.
Musty?
Leafy.
Leafy? Leafy. Yeah.
Forest glory.
Forest glory. Any other smells? So if you brush it against your lips, what do you feel? I'll just demonstrate.
Tickling. It's a kiss.
Soft.
It's quite nice, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh. Now I'm not gonna. The next thing with the raisin will be to eat it, but I will stop there. So yeah, the qualities that you've called out or shared are the qualities of leafiness. And this is what secular mindfulness would help you explore. I mean, it would take longer. You'd really, really take it in. You'd really look at it, and the one I've got is truly gorgeous, and I imagine yours are too. But now for the Dharma, okay? So, that is the Dharma. That is what we've just done. That is a great, lovely way of approaching mindfulness. But the Dharma takes it a bit further. So does anyone have one that isn't quite a leaf, that's not quite in a leafy, in a fully leafy state, I wonder? What about your one, Amanda?
This one is. Yeah,
what would you call that one? Is it a leaf?
It is, but...
Hold it right up.
Quite unusual.
Yeah.
And very
unusual colours. It's verging on non-leaf, I reckon.
Yeah.
I've got a few here. What are these ones?
Dying.
Are they leaves?
Yeah,
they're
still leaves.
They're still leaves, okay. What else have I got here? What about this? What's this one? If you can see it. It's, is it a bird? It's got a stalk.
Is it a seed pod?
It's a dead leaf. So if I go like this, and do that, is it still a dead leaf or is it something else? It just fell on the ground. Okay, if I go like this, what is it?
A broken leaf.
Broken leaf. If you saw this on the ground, which I won't do, would you think broken leaf or would you think something else? Mulch. It's turned into something else. At some point between this and that and that and that, it turned into
dirt. It's transformed.
It's transformed, right.
Well, our label for it has
it's
changed.
Our label for it has changed, yeah. So that's the Dharma. I mean, I'm doing this quite quickly, but there's something really interesting in noting when something, how our labels are inadequate or something like that, or when something, what the qualities are of the things we apply labels to, and how many of those qualities need to be present for it to be that label. I think maybe if I hadn't had you all looking at those leaves you've got in your hand, you wouldn't have called this a leaf. I'm not sure. It might have turned into something else before. Certainly this, you wouldn't have thought it was a leaf, you would have thought, oh, a bit of dirt. And the next step would be to go, well, how do you know that thing you're calling a leaf isn't you? How do you know? How can you tell?
I can't tell, really.
You get an A plus. You can't tell, really.
It might be.
It might be you.
It's not attached.
It's not attached. It's not attached. You can go like this. That suggests it might not be you. Yeah.
It doesn't hurt, man.
It doesn't hurt. Yeah, but it doesn't hurt when you do that to your hair. Doesn't hurt. Might do. Fingernails. You can cut your fingernails off. So there's loads of kind of mental tests that we do without even thinking to determine if something is, well, me or not me. If we can detach it, we think it's not me, apart from toenails, of course. Or hair? Or teeth? I don't know. When do toenails become not me?
When they cut off.
When they cut off, straight away. The minute they leave the toe.
You've got your DNA in that
guy. Uh-huh.
Yeah, and your hair.
Your understanding of what is me.
Pardon?
But they no longer fit your understanding of what is me.
Oh, we'd rather they weren't us, right? Old toenails. Anyway, okay, whatever else. Okay, that's just a kind of a taste of the ways we might look at ourselves in the world if we were deeply exploring our experience through the lens of the Dharma. And that takes us a little bit beyond secular mindfulness, I think. And it's profoundly transformative, that kind of inquiry, I suppose. Yeah, I mean, in 5 minutes you can't get much of a taste of it, but it is profoundly transformative. So this sati, this kind of awareness that's on the Eightfold Path, it doesn't assume anything. It kind of tries to strip back our natural assumptions, or the assumptions that we take for granted, as if it's a given that if something's not attached, if I can let go of something, it can't be me. It strips back those assumptions and gets us, well, encourages us to be really curious and attentive, and also to be deeply caring about our experience, whether it's, you know, the experience labelled me or the experience labelled out there. And we need a real persistence and a willingness to be with not knowing to do that. It's quite uncomfortable just to start thinking about, well, could that be me, or is it not, or how is it not? You know, it needs to be a real ability to stay with the not known. And even more radically, and this is really the whole point of the Dharma, is it shifts our natural tendency or natural habit of attending to the self outwards, so that we're attending as much, if not more, to other, to the world. I could go on about that for longer, but I won't. That's a whole retreat, a whole lifetime of practice, really, just, you know, encompassed in that really brief introduction to sati and little leaf exercise. So I'm going to move on to samadhi, and you spell it, I don't know if you can see the board up there, but the first writing in red, perfect awareness and samadhi with Vajrajyoti, that's samadhi, which I better define. It's not so easy to define because it's used differently by early Buddhists and by later Buddhists. So the early Buddhists, that is, they're called the Theravadins normally. Sorry. So they tended to use the word samadhi to refer to mental concentration or one-pointedness. So more like that focused attention that I was saying sati isn't. On the other hand, the later traditions, say the Mahayana or Vajrayana, they use the word samadhi to mean awakening or enlightenment. So quite different uses of the word. So in the latter sense, in the latter definition, samadhi really is the, you know, the last stage of the Eightfold Path. But in the former sense, it's like another tool or quality that helps us on the way, that helps us in the jungle.
And modern day teachers mainly use the word samadhi in that first way as a kind of a sense of focused attention or concentration. And it's normally talked about as being a quality that we develop through meditation, but of course, cultivate in our everyday life as well. And the word samadhi is related to the word collect. Remember how sati was related to recollect, as in remember. Samadhi is related to collect. So slightly different, but similar. So samadhi is about collecting oneself together, a unification of mind and body. And this coming together of what are often disparate elements or activities of mind and body results in concentration, calmness, stability, and a steadiness of mind and a deep sense of, it's not quite relaxation, but something like that, an alert relaxation. If you just imagine all the energies of mind and body all coming together so they're not pulling off all the time in other directions. And in this state of samadhi, the mind is very flexible, very subtle and very creative. It's not dull or flat, it's very pliable. And it's not the sort of concentration that you might experience, or if you're me, when you're sitting at the computer, you know, working away, or when you're concentrating on a difficult task. It includes a very deep and satisfying sense of well-being, a sense of being all of yourself, all in one place right now, and very happy to be there. So those of you who were here last week, for Sarah's talk, you would have heard her mention the dhyanas. So the dhyanas are states of consciousness or states of mind that can occur in meditation and also can occur outside meditation. We normally think of them in terms of meditative states. And they occur as the mind becomes more concentrated, when there's more samadhi present. And Sarah used a number of metaphors to illustrate the feel of the dhyanas. So, for example, the metaphors are very lovely, but I'll just give one example. So the second, there's four dhyanas that one might enter, maybe possibly without too much difficulty in meditation, and what are called the four formless dhyanas, which are more distant. Anyway, the second dhyana, of the more accessible ones, it's said to be like a clear, calm lake fed by an underground spring. So very lovely. Clear, calm lake with an underground spring just welling up. And these states of consciousness are very accessible for some people. They just sit down and meditate and there they are. Particularly for people when they learn to meditate, interestingly enough. And they're not that accessible for others. But I know that sometimes our meditation practice can really is help us see how busy our minds are, which can be a bit disappointing if we thought we were going to come and learn to meditate in order to, you know, be really quiet and clear and calm. And then you sit down to meditate and you just see how crazy the mind is. But meditating more regularly, it eases that pressure of activity, of fantasies and worries and regrets and all that stuff that the mind does. So that all just dissolves a bit. And then going on retreat, where conditions are much more simple and more supportive of meditation practice, is likely to result in even more deeper and more pleasurable meditation where the dhyanas are more likely to be present. So when I'm living in Auckland, leading my rather busy life, I need to reassure myself often that in meditation at least I give myself an opportunity to explore the texture and tone and pace of my mind. Even if there's no sense of calming and deepening, I can at least get to know what's going on. And sometimes those kind of slightly addictive thoughts ease off and there's a bit more peace and quiet. But I've also learned, and here I'm coming back to pleasure, that those kind of high, not high level, they're not high level, the kind of superficial thinking that we do a lot of the time, that we'll catch ourselves doing, is only a very superficial covering, and that it sometimes doesn't take much to drop down through it. Given a kindly attitude, actually. So I've learned that trying to push distractions away does not make them go away. I can't make them go away. They are very stubborn mental distractions of a busy mind. But if I look for pleasure in my experience, the distractions sometimes just ease off because a pleased mind is a calmer mind. So looking for pleasure deeper down, maybe in physical experience, just the feel of the breath or whatever, the mind can just relax into that pleasure and all those distractions, not all of them, some of them just ease off a little. So tuning into pleasure, I mean, it's quite a knack, actually. That's not especially easy. But once you know the habitual tendencies of your mind, you can learn to tune into pleasure, and it does make meditation much more satisfying. And my big point, my other big point, apart from pleasure and care, is stop multitasking. Stop multitasking. It is bad. It is bad, bad, bad. If you want to cultivate samadhi, stop multitasking. I will tell you why, because I'm so adamant, because I know for a fact, I know from my own experience that multitasking is wicked for the mind. I mean, you're all nodding, you all know, but anyway, last weekend, not this weekend just gone, the one before, I had a weekend where I was free-ish. I could sit down and think about samadhi and sati and prepare, you know, what I was going to say tonight. But then I thought, oh, shit, I've got that motorbike, I need to sell it, I'll just put it on Trade Me. As you know. So I, you know, got up early Saturday morning, cleaned the motorbike, took hours, photographed it, learned how to work the phone and the camera and the computer connection thing and put it up on Trade Me, which took a while. And I made a mistake when I put it up, which meant it was going to be sold that day. And then, yes, I know. You wouldn't have done that, would you? No, most people wouldn't do that. But I had 10 hours to sell it in because of the way I listed it. and it was an auction. It was, you know. And then I sat down. I thought, oh, well, while it's, you know, being sold, I'll listen to a talk in preparation for this talk. And I did something I've never done. I don't think I've ever done it. No, I wasn't listening to a talk. Yeah, I was listening to a talk. And watching the Trade Me bids at the same time, it was really bad. It was horrible. I mean, it was kind of compulsive at the time.
It was a talk on mindfulness.
Yeah. It was a talk on this. It's crazy. Listening to a talk, yeah, watching the bids come in. And it was like addictive. I could feel, I knew it was not a bad idea, but I couldn't, you know, I couldn't stop myself. By the end of Saturday, I sold my bike, I had my money, it was all very satisfying in that respect. But my mind was a mess. My mind was a mess, and it took ages. It took days, actually, to kind of calm down. A kind of a sense of, of course money makes a mess of the mind anyway sometimes. You know, a whole lot of stuff gets stimulated. But it was the multitasking mainly, I think, that did it. A kind of shattering of the mind. Oh, no, shattering's a bit too strong, but a kind of sense of disintegration, which took days to, I don't know if the words heal, but something like that. So, stop multitasking. I mean, younger people might be able to do it better. I don't know. Your minds might be more, flexible or something, but.
It's just our attention.
Back and forth. I know.
You only pay attention to one thing at a time.
Yeah.
That's why we get that.
That shattered feeling. Yeah. So, to summarise,
Oh yeah, stop multitasking. And what you do instead is you, as well as selling things on TradeMe, if you must, if you need to, of course, is to find simple things to do, simple things that you enjoy, and very simple things can be deeply enjoyable. You can, I mean, you all know what it's like to, I don't know, walk on the lawn in bare feet in the early morning. It's just lovely. Or watch a bee on a flower, or see a new moon. I mean, look at a leaf. Yeah, if I had have done, or even if I'd done all of that all weekend, the multitasking, and then sat for half an hour and looked at a leaf, I think that would have been kind of very healing, actually. I think perhaps just something very simple, but it also has to be engaging, would have done some quite rapid kind of mind healing work. Oh, God, I was tempted then to tell you about the scooter, but that was just another kind of... that I bought, but that was another bad example. So I'm just going to summarise now. So I talked at some length about samadhi, about sati or awareness or mindfulness. I talked about how this is a revolutionary quality. It's not necessarily easy, but it does turn everything around and upside down. It will literally transform your life and catalyse or generate a state of freedom and a deep sense of connection with all things, all beings. And then I talked more briefly about samadhi or concentration or enlightenment. And Sangharakshita, the founder of our movement, he makes the point that, actually I like this, that the more profound the concept is, the less easy it is to describe. So there's less words to describe samadhi. I use less words to describe samadhi because it's a much more profound concept. And as I said, it's sometimes used to mean concentration and the highly pleasurable states that can arise when we're very concentrated. But its higher meaning or deeper meaning is awakening or enlightenment. And this is when you realise that the jungle is really you, and that you are really the jungle, or the, you know, the leaf is really you, and you are really the leaf. And it's not surprising, is it, that words are inadequate to describe the well, the shift in consciousness that comes about when one really deeply realises that lack of separation, lack of distance between self and other. That's me.